All right, I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, the author of a brand new book called End of Empires, Africa, African Americans and India. And I guess the first question I wanted to ask you is that there is a lot of activity going on the small planet that we call Earth. There is the there was the G20 meeting, and also there's the NATO meeting. I'd like to get your thoughts on both of those meetings.
Well, with regard to the G20 meeting, I think it's a mixed bag. There are both positive and negative headlines emerging from this meeting. First of all, the positive, which I think in the long run will be the most substantial. I think it is important to note that this is one of the first times in history where an important international meeting has taken place where the majority of the planet's inhabitants are represented. That is to say, if you go back to the founding of the United Nations, for example, and particularly the creation of the United Nations Security Council, which, as you know, only has one member that is not from the North Atlantic nations. Of course, I'm speaking of China. And then, of course, it has Russian representation as well. And if you look at the other important meetings, the Bretton Woods meeting in 1944 that led to the creation of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, both of which have an informal system that says either one or the other has to be led by a European or by someone from the United States. But at the G20 meeting that just unfolded in London, you had South Africa represented, you had China represented, you had Indonesia, India, South Korea, Mexico, Brazil, Argentina. It was quite remarkable in that respect. And that's good news. Now, with regard to the negative, I think it was quite unfortunate, number one, that only one African nation was represented at this important meeting, and that's South Africa. Number two, it seemed that the communique from the G20 meeting is trying to breathe new life into the discredited International Monetary Fund, which is no more than a vampire sucking the lifeblood out of distressed nations in particular. And I think it was quite unfortunate and troublesome that the IMF has such pride of place with regard to the communique coming out of the G20 meeting. But overall, I would really like to stress other elements. One, of course, the fact that it's clear that the United States has been brought down a peg. It's clear that this was the view on the international stage of a rising China. And that is something that we all need to think about and what the consequences of that will be. Similarly, I think it was important that it appears that Moscow and Washington are going to be moving towards sharp reductions in nuclear weaponry. I think we can all breathe a sigh of relief as a result of that decision, and hopefully it will be concretized. So overall, I think the G20 meeting was a mixed bag with both positive and negative. Now, with regard to NATO, it's difficult to say anything positive about this meeting that's unfolding at the European Parliament in Strasbourg, and that, of course, will be continuing after that. Quite frankly, NATO, which is marking its 60th anniversary, has lost its reason for being. It was brought into being in 1949, supposedly to confront the alleged Soviet threat. The Soviet Union has disappeared. NATO is still around. They still have these, what they call, out-of-area missions. You know, of course, about the fact that Canada is participating in this NATO mission in Afghanistan, which is not going very well. And NATO, quite frankly, needs to be subjected to euthanasia. It needs to be brought to a soft landing and then done away with, because it serves no useful purpose, and quite frankly, it's no more than an arm of an imperialist aggression machine.
You're listening to The Horn Report featuring Norman Otis Richmond, and I wanted to move on to Afghanistan now. The Canadian government recently has been dressing down Mr. Karzai because of his position on his proposed new laws regarding Shia women. And apparently they are taking the position that Shia women are going to have, are going to have to go back to the Stone Ages and report to their husbands and so on and so forth. I'd like to get your thoughts on Afghanistan and the women question, which was supposedly the reason why, I guess, America went in there in the first place, according to George Bush, being the great feminist that he was and is?
Well, the law you make reference to, as I understand it, is basically seeking to legalize marital rape. But this is quite unfortunate that young men and women from Canada are being asked to lay down their lives, to make the ultimate sacrifice, in order that such reactionary legislation should be passed. I think that's only one more reason why Canada and indeed NATO need to reconsider the entire Afghan mission. I recall an interview I recently saw with President Obama of the United States. He said the most distressing aspect of his job is being presented with a decision where, because of past blunders, the options that he has are basically between bad and worse. And I think that he may have been referring to his decisions with regard to Afghanistan, because you cannot understand the NATO mission there or the dilemma that Canada and NATO face without understanding the past history and how, as a result of the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, the largest covert operation in the history of the Central Intelligence Agency, basically commencing before the Soviet intervention of December 1979, this U.S. intervention, which involved a collaboration with some of the most retrograde elements on the planet, including those tied to Osama bin Laden himself, basically as a result of that U.S. CIA intervention, you basically had many progressive elements in Afghanistan who were wiped out. And the ideological hegemons, if you like, in Afghanistan right now are basically retrograde elements that passed this kind of marital rape legislation, which has the international community in an uproar. So no good, it seems to me, can be coming from this Afghan intervention. On the other hand, it's difficult to see what the way out is in light of the fact that the routing progressive forces in that Central Asian country has led to an ideologically distorted situation to the point where someone as backward as President Hamid Karzai can be considered a progressive force in Afghanistan, which is quite mind-boggling if you think about it for more than a nanosecond.
Well, I wanted to say, make a rare statement and say something very positive about President Obama. I think what he did with the stem cell, his legislation on stem cell research, is a very positive move, and it's a move forward for scientific people. And I'd like to get your thoughts on that, as well as his stand on Afghanistan. He was supposed to have a review, and do you think the stand that he's going to take on Afghanistan of sending, I guess, 17,000 troops and 4,000 advisors, is that going to be a positive step or a retrograde step?
Well, I have to say that we all are disappointed with this recent decision with regard to Afghanistan. I understand his position, which is that it was in Afghanistan and on the Afghan-Pakistan border that you had the plotting that led to the attack on Manhattan and Washington, September 11, 2001, and not to mention the attack on the World Trade Center in New York in 1993. But having said that, it seems to me that militarizing the situation in Afghanistan, that no good can come from that. That, on the other hand, I do think it's important to point out that he is not sending military troops alone. There are a number of civilians. There is a development component of this new Afghan strategy. But quite frankly, I think that Washington has dug itself a very deep hole with regard to Afghanistan because of the aforesaid intervention in the 1970s that basically distorted the country and basically led to a routing of progressive forces. So it's difficult to see a positive way out. Now, with regard to stem cell, this is one of the a number of positive decisions that this new administration has made that have reversed past decisions of the Bush administration. However, if we step back for a moment and look in a historical perspective, I think it's important to note that this administration, I believe, will be disappointing a number of progressive forces going forward. Not necessarily because this administration has conservative instincts, as some of its detractors like to suggest. I think it's basic we have to confess that because of the history of the United States, because of the way it was founded in order to preserve slavery in many ways, although they tell it was to basically preserve liberty, the long years of Jim Crow and apartheid, that this is basically a country with a disproportionate number of retrograde elements. And as a result, it would be difficult for President Norman Otis Richmond to right this ship and turn it in a progressive direction. Once again, I think it's going to have to be international intervention that helps to pull the United States out of its morass. And that returns me to the G20 meeting, because one of the important aspects of this G20 meeting was the pressure that it placed on the United States to reform its cowboy capitalism. That probably will take place because of this pressure from the international community. So once again, we see how the retrograde forces of the United States, who have brought to the fore this very aggressive and monstrously backwards form of capitalism, are being forced to heal, not necessarily by the people of the United States, but by the weight of the international community. And so therefore, I think that's another important aspect of the G20 meeting that I'm afraid even progressive commentators have missed.
Yes, I agree with you, because I think that President Obama personally is probably a nice human being, a nice brother. I would even go so far as to say that, but he has been handed a situation almost like, you know, inheriting the Titanic, which is, I think that it's not the man, it's the plan. But I wanted to go on and talk about George Galloway, gentleman from the UK, the parliamentarian from the UK, tried to visit Canada, could not get in, apparently because he was supposed to have given some assistance to Hamas. He subsequently was barred from Canada, and he spoke through a video. Modern technology, once again, science helped him, and he spoke to about 1,000 people at a church, the United Church here in Toronto. And this was beamed in 20 Canadian cities and also in Greece. And he is supposed to be a person that is very pro the Palestinians. He's made it very clear that he is not anti-Semitic. But Stephen Harper and his government have banned George Galloway. Did that get much interest in the United States?
Well, certainly amongst the progressive media, quite frankly, I was rather puzzled by the decision of the Ottawa authorities, because you know that they have allowed George W. Bush into your country, despite the fact that he is a putative war criminal, despite the fact that he has blood on his hands. I understand that Mr. Bush's vice president, Dick Cheney, may also be visiting your country, and I assume he too will have no problem getting a visa. So to allow or not to allow George Galloway into the country on these obvious accusations and allegations is rather puzzling and mind-boggling, and I think it's also disappointing. At the same time, it should be mentioned that the Bush team might be looking twice at the foreign countries they may want to visit, because as you may have heard, there is a Spanish magistrate who apparently is planning to indict the former Bush Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and a number of his confederates because of the concerns about torture at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, at the U.S. prison camp there. I assume that they will also be walking up the chain of command to Mr. Bush and to Mr. Cheney as well. Once again, we see the international community that is trying to bring the United States to heel, because the Obama administration has made clear that they believe in looking forward, not backwards. As they put it, they don't believe in criminalizing policy differences. And so, quite literally, they're going to allow the Bush team to get away with murder, a very dangerous president. But, once again, it's the international community that is intervening to make sure that this kind of travesty of justice does not take place.
Could you comment on the current, what is your analysis of the new administration in Israel it doesn't look too promising to me. I would like to hear your thoughts on it.
You mean overall?
Yeah, in terms of the new government. Well, I guess we should say that. Could you explain the fact that there has been an election and what players are in place in the state of Israel, and how do you feel they're going to move forward?
Well, it's very disappointing. I mean, first of all, once again, we should not just point to the leaders. We should look at the electorate, just like in the United States. And the fact is, the electorate in Israel has moved sharply to the right. That's the only explanation for the regime of Bibi Netanyahu, who we know as a retrograde conservative. But because the electorate has moved so far to the right, he is appearing as a centrist. His foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, has a justifiable reputation as an anti-Arab racist. Once again, he has roots in the former Soviet Union. And recall, if you like, the campaigns that took place in the 1970s and 1980s for Soviet Jewry. We were told that they were being persecuted and that everything should be done to get them out of the Soviet Union before some sort of Holocaust were to take place. Now we see in the cold light of history that basically many people were seduced, introduced by propaganda, that these men and women who came to Israel from the former Soviet Union basically helped to bolster and buttress the ultra-right wing, with Mr. Lieberman being Exhibit A in that regard. And quite frankly, I think that those who participated in those campaigns may want to extend an apology to Moscow, or extend an apology to those who were critical of those campaigns, such as myself, for example. Because now we see that with this Lieberman-Netanyahu regime in place in Israel that has basically repudiated the peace process, it's quite alarming. And they're now talking more and more about bombing Iran, which would be, quite frankly, opening the gates of hell. It's a very dangerous situation that we must keep a close eye on.
You're listening to the Horn Report. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, and I'd like to move to Africa. And could you give me your assessment of the current situation in the Sudan, Zimbabwe, and South Africa?
Well, with regard to the Sudan, as you well know, the president of that country fundamentally has been indicted by the International Criminal Court. This indictment has basically been rejected by his neighbors, not least of whom are the Arab League and the African Union. The president of Syria basically gave a speech at an Arab League meeting a few days ago. He wondered when the leaders of Israel were going to be indicted because of their criminal aggression against Gaza in January 2009. When would George Bush be indicted, I would add, because of his criminal aggression? Once again, we see this double standard when it comes to African leaders. They're basically trying to turn a laudable institution, or a potentially laudable institution like the International Criminal Court in The Hague, into a tool of neocolonial aggression, and this must not stand. Zimbabwe seems to be settling down. I find it quite curious that the people of Zimbabwe seem to be breathing a sigh of relief as a result of this concord between the opposition and the ruling ZANU-PF party. They are happy the civil war was averted. Yet I notice that outside of Zimbabwe, particularly here in North America, there seems to be disgust with this concord. It seems that they had this taste in their mouth for getting the hide of Robert Mugabe, and since that has not happened, they seem to be disappointed. Keep in mind that a few days ago, you'll recall that the wife of the prime minister, Mr. Tsvangirai, was killed in an automobile accident. And immediately, the press and the North Atlantic nations tried to suggest that the Mugabe forces were behind this unfortunate and tragic accident. It turns out, of course, that the car that hit the vehicle that was carrying the spouse of the prime minister was driven by a contractor from the United States. And apparently this is not the first time that some sort of suspicious incident or accident has taken place that involved a U.S. contractor. Now, even though I immediately alerted even progressive organs here in the United States about this very curious fact, there was no follow-up, no investigation. It's quite unfortunate and quite frankly indicative of this kind of double standard that we see when it comes to reporting on Africa and Zimbabwe in particular. The South African elections take place towards the end of the month, April 2009. thus far, it seems like Jacob Zuma will be the new South African president. The prosecutors in South Africa will be making a decision rather shortly as to whether or not they're going to indict him for past transgressions. The word on the street is that they're going to drop the indictment, but right now it's too soon to tell.
Okay, I would be remiss if I did not mention the Democratic Republic of Congo. I mean, that is a situation that gets little or no play in the Western press. A couple of months ago, I went and I checked the Los Angeles Times, and like you say, most of the information was Mugabe this, Mugabe that. Very little about the Democratic Republic of Congo, if anything. What is the current situation in the DRC?
Well, the Kabila regime is still in power in Kinshasa. Most of the troubles in the Congo, as you know, are taking place in the eastern Congo, and those problems continue. On the one hand, you have those who have been accused of genocide in Rwanda, the so-called Hutu nationalists that are encamped in eastern Congo and wreaking havoc. They are periodically attacked by the government in Kigali, Rwanda, which, of course, keeps eastern Congo in a state of turmoil. Then in eastern Congo, you have indigenous forces, they're called warlords routinely, who are involved in plunder of no small import because, as you know, eastern Congo is a vast storehouse of mineral and raw material wealth that tends to attract those kinds of forces. And then you have the problem in neighboring Uganda, and in Sudan. Now, we talked about, of course, the problem in Darfur that led to the indictment of the president of Sudan, but in southern Sudan, you still have an ongoing conflict, even though the issue has been basically settled. But still, it's a very poor part of the country. It's a part of the country that has all manner of problems. And then, of course, in neighboring Uganda, you have the continual issue of the so-called Lord's Resistance Army and the kinds of depredations that it has been committing. So it would not be unfair to suggest that that part of the world, in the cockpit of Africa, Central Africa, Congo, Rwanda, Sudan, Uganda, is, I'm afraid, one of the most troubled areas on this small planet and certainly deserves more attention than it has received thus far.
And you're listening to Dr. Gerald Horn, author of a new book called The End of Empires, African Americans and India. And I wanted to move on and talk about sports, but this is not going to be that. We have a few more minutes, but when we talk about sports, we have a political edge to it. Now, the World Baseball Classic recently took place, and the Japanese came out first, the Koreans second. And I know, and most people know, that imperialism spread baseball. U.S. imperialism took baseball to wherever they had forces, you know, wherever they colonized or they had sway in those particular situations, just as cricket was brought to a lot of the world through British imperialism. Now, I listen to quite a bit of talk radio, sports radio, and a lot of the American commentators, the United States commentators, were quite upset about the World Baseball Classic. They don't think that America should participate because it's in the beginning of the season, and some of their Mets, I was listening to one guy who is a big Met fan, and someone from the Mets got hurt, so he feels that, you know, America should not compete in this situation. But I think that it's a case of the world has caught up and is catching up with America on many, many issues, including sports, and it sounds like a little sour grapes. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I tend to agree with you. I think that what happened in the World Baseball Classic, just like the G20 meeting, was further evidence, if any were needed, that you're seeing a steady erosion of the prestige and the power of U.S. imperialism. This has to be good news, even if it happens on a baseball diamond. On the other hand, I have to say, like Fidel Castro, I was rather taken aback by the setbacks of the Cuban team. We have become accustomed to the Cuban team doing quite well in these international baseball events, but this did not take place this time. although quite frankly, it may be more of a reflection on the power of the Japanese team and the power of the South Korean team and the power of the Asian teams, more so than it is a reflection on the decline of the Cuban team.
Could you comment on the fact that imperialism brought these sports to various people? I think Beyond the Boundary, which is a book by C.L.R. James, talked about cricket and how, I guess, Caribbean people at one point had taken cricket from the British and were able to become the, at one point, were the top dogs in cricket. It's Caribbean is not doing too well right now in the international cricket situation. Could you talk about how imperialism indeed took sports and took these sports around the world?
Well, look at Japan, for example. You know, of course, that the beginning of the end for feudalism in Japan was in the 1860s with the Meiji Restoration. And Japan at that time sent teams around the world to look at various cultures and best practices. And one of the things that they decided to import into their country was baseball. And at the same time, of course, imperialism as a way to get cultural currency, if you like, in Japan, was simultaneously trying to export baseball around the world. Professional baseball basically begins in the United States in the 1860s, and the exporting of that particular sport takes place at the same time that Japan is beginning to look around the world for cultural practices to emulate. With regard to Cuba and Dominican Republic in particular, you begin to see the appearance of baseball at a heightened level after the War of 1898, where, if you recall, Cuba is basically snatched away from the Spanish Empire by the rapacious Yankees. And at the same time, you begin to see Cuba arise in baseball arise in Cuba's neighbor, that is to say, the Dominican Republic, which today, I think it's fair to say, pound for pound and on a per capita basis, is probably the leading baseball power in the world.
Okay, this is going to be, I'm going to double up or triple up these questions because we have, I guess, about 3 minutes. I wanted to ask you to talk about the passing of Janet Jagan, a very important woman from Chicago who once was the president of Guyana. I also would like to ask you about the passing of Mel Brown, who was used to be Bobby Bland's band leader, great guitarist, who passed away in Ontario, by the way. And the last thing is, could you comment on the fact that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is going to take place, I guess, tomorrow night? This interview is being done on the 3rd of April. And on the 4th of April, Bobby Womack, Little Anthony and the Imperials and Run DMC will be inducted into the Hall of Fame. But I'm interested on your thoughts on Bobby Womack, because I know you have talked about him many times on these airwaves.
Well, Janet Jagan, I'm happy to say that I was fortunate to have known her. I knew her and her late spouse, Chetty Jagan. It's a remarkable loss. It's quite striking that in 1943, the former Janet Rosenberg met the dental student at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, one Chetty Jagan. And the rest is history. They fell in love. They got married. They returned to what was then British Guyana, began organizing, helped to found the People's Progressive Party in what is now Guyana, still one of the leading progressive forces in that part of the world. And over the years, she gave her life, quite literally, to the people of her adopted country. And certainly she will be missed, and certainly she will go down in history as an exemplar of a certain kind of selfless internationalism. Now, with regard to Mel Brown and with regard to Bobby Womack, well, certainly the loss of Mel Brown cannot be gainsaid. His guitar plucking will certainly be missed forevermore. And when I think of Bobby Womack, I think of his almost literally trying to walk in the footsteps of Sam Cooke, his late mentor, who you may recall was murdered, in fact, in Los Angeles as a result of an unfortunate misunderstanding. And at that time, the young Bobby Womack apparently was so struck by this tragedy that he almost literally tried to walk in his footsteps. It's a remarkable story and certainly worthy of cinematic treatment.
I would agree. I've reread his autobiography, Midnight Mover, and if you read that book, it's definitely it's worthy of silver screen treatment. I would like to thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, but it's good to hear your voice again, and I look forward to talking with you once more.
Thank you very much. And we have been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of the great book, The End of Empires, African Americans and India. Take care.
Bye-bye.
I want to dedicate this song to all the lovers tonight. And I expect that might be the whole world, because everybody needs something or someone to love. When it's cold outside, who are you holding? You know, if y'all don't mind, I'd like to talk about this woman of mine. She's always complaining about me never being at home. But when I'm there, I'm broke. Telling me about the things that a girlfriend's got and what she ain't got, and she want me to go out and get them for her. But girl, I can't be in two places at one time. If you think you're lonely now, wait until tonight, girl. I'll be more.
Wait. If you think you're lonely now.
Someone, baby, 'cause I've done my time.